Tom Chick. You're listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. This week we will be discussing Edge of Darkness. I am here with Christian Mrstaski. Did I get it? Mrstaski. Christian Mrstaski.
That's Captain Mrstaski to you.
Captain of what?
Exactly.
We are also here with Kelly Wand, who I hope has a tagline for us. Kelly Wand, do you have a tagline for us?
I do. Without Jews, there'd be no anti-Semitism. A little Mel Gibson quote for you. I just made up.
It's very good.
Thank you. It's almost too good
Jews,
for
me. Yeah. The Jews are the cause of all the anti-Semitism.
Yeah, damn them.
Now, this week, did you guys see any sign? This movie was blissfully free of Mel Gibson wackiness. There was no anti-Semitism. There was no, as I mentioned last week, he didn't call anyone sugar tits. We didn't get that.
Wait, in real life or the movie? What are you talking about?
You know what? I don't know in real life. Was there any, they obviously shot this in Boston. Does anybody know if there was any controversy in Boston? Did Mel Gibson offend anyone in Boston when they were shooting Edge of Darkness?
Just the New York fans.
Okay.
You wouldn't get that.
It's a sports thing because the Boston Yankees and the New York Giants are constantly at loggerheads, right?
Loggerheads? I don't speak sports.
So actually, you know, Kelly Wand.
That's a bar, actually, in Boston.
Loggerheads, eh?
Let me explain to you, Kelly Wand. I know a few things about sports, and I do know that there's rivalry between Boston and New York, and the reason I know that is because in the opening of Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds remake,
right, he's pissed
he and his son, exactly, have a little rivalry. And when I first saw the movie, I was like, what? Why does he care about the hat? Oh, what? And
well, so Boston survives the War of the Worlds totally unscarred,
right.
And New
exactly.
York gets annihilated.
Yep.
Suck it, New York.
Now, this movie was set in Boston. This movie, you could say, was a love letter to Boston.
Ugh,
I wouldn't
like
say that.
Written by the same guy.
Was it? It was not. He just writes Boston movies?
Don't Dennis Lehane?
No, his name is William Monahan.
Oh.
Wait, so you see, all right. That's true? The same guy wrote The Departed and this Payback Meets Silkwood movie?
Absolutely. Saw. Yeah, I promise. I promise that's true.
No, I actually I remember that from the credits. And by the way, Kelly Wand, do that again. What was your little what meets what pitch for this movie? Because I think that was beautiful.
Payback Meets Silkwood.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. I think we're done here.
Yeah, I don't know
one,
what else
two,
to say
three.
About it.
Well, let's go around the room. Kelly Wand, what was your impression of Edge of Darkness?
I liked it. I didn't hate it. But by the end, I realized it had been the same scene for the whole movie, and it needed more. The thing I liked about the movie was that it was kind of talky and not much slappy, but a lot of yappy. But then by the end, I was like, it didn't have enough slappy.
That was good. All right, Dingus, what's your...
I liked the yappy. Okay, sorry.
Okay, good. Dingus, how'd you feel?
I really felt like it was unremittingly bad. And that I every time I saw a scene, I thought, this is the exact wrong scene, and you guys have chosen the exact wrong scene to show, and you should have shown a completely different scene. And I think there's a story here to be told, and they chose every wrong scene to tell it.
Okay. I'm going to take my turn. I liked it. I did like it. I think maybe even a little bit more than Kelly. I had some reservations, but I liked some of the things that were different about it. And the things that I didn't like about it, I later found out why they are that way, and we can talk about that in a little bit. I think I'm the most upbeat about it amongst the three of us.
Well, what are you comparing it to? The Legion?
Well, it's it's really. I mean, the bottom line for Edge of Darkness, it's a potboiler. It's your standard issue thriller. I mean, it's so by the numbers. There are a few exceptions to that, but it's mostly nothing we haven't seen before. And some of the things that we have seen before, I rolled my eyes several times. But Kelly, your thing about it being more yappy and less slappy, for a thriller, it was almost an anti-thriller. It was really morose and somber.
And he played very against type, and I thought that was a bold choice.
Yes.
I just thought that the
story... Wait a minute. How did he play against type?
because he was kind of a big pussy. Like, he'd never shoot anybody, and he'd just walk away, and he tried to do everything legally for a really long time into the movie, like, almost up to the end, like, way after he should have, even. Although...
Wait a minute, he's beating up all kinds of people, and...
Yeah, there's no investigation.
What are you talking about, either? What are you talking
he's
about?
Playing, here,
he goes
here,
to senators and goes investigate this. That's being legal, as opposed to...
Yeah, and he has a great scene where he says, Go ahead, Tom.
Well, he's not doing, it's like Kelly Wanda's saying, it's less slappy. You know, this is not Payback, where he wanders into, which is a great movie, where he just wanders into the henchman's lair and starts roughing up people. He doesn't do that. He does play a very somber, morose, bereaved father who's lost his daughter, who's a little confused and often isn't sure what to do. And I think, I want to talk about this, but he commits suicide, doesn't he? Doesn't he drink the radioactive milk?
I thought he was infected already from touching her and having her lock of hair and stuff.
No, he's accidentally poisoned.
How?
At best. By being close to any...
They knew he was poisoned.
Wait. Hold on. But I want to... Dingus, go ahead. What's your theory? Because I have a theory. I want to know what happens to him in the end, because that's... I think it's crucial, and it's part of what I think I liked about the movie, and I want to make sure I'm not wrong.
You're right. I'll like it more.
Okay, so Dingus, how is it that you think he gets poisoned?
Well, they make a bunch of veiled references to the fact that he's been poisoned in their ridiculous conspiratorial scenes. But he's been poisoned just by being around. I mean,
being around
her, and then being around her hair, and then being around the milk. We're just supposed to assume.
Dingus, that's not how radiation.
There's any support.
But this is
Hold on a second. Dingus, that is not how radiation poisoning works. The model for this clearly is the journalist the Russian journalist in Britain who was killed. I mean, obviously the girl was given some kind of poison. You are not going to get radiation poisoning from carrying a lock of hair that registers on a Geiger counter.
I thought that too, but then I thought, oh, this is a...
So hold on, Kelly. Hold on. So Dingus, do you... I mean, I'm not trying to corner anyone. I just wanted to see if I could be right about this. Do you still think that that's the case, Dingus, that it was just sort of that sloppy storytelling and that it was just him being close to her, that that's what the movie wants you to think infected him?
I have no doubt that it's sloppy storytelling, because you're talking about a movie here that is
consistent. No, Dingus,
you're talking about a movie that is consistent in its insistence that we poison a person and then we shoot them, and this happens again.
Okay,
and
Dingus.
Again.
Okay, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the overall point, but I think you're definitely wrong. You do not get radiation poisoning from carrying around a radioactive lock of hair.
He didn't say that, though, I don't think.
No, well, that matters.
Also from being around her. So
it
I think here's
it
the
doesn't matter to this movie, and you if you're
yes it does to matter to this movie, and here's why it matters to this movie. This movie is called Edge of Darkness for a couple of reasons. One of the main things the movie is getting at is that both Mel Gibson and Ray Winstone are fatally infected and are going to die, and I think that Mel Gibson does it by his own hand. Ray Winstone, it's something that's visited upon him, he can't avoid, and he embraces it in the end. But I think their mutual suicides is part of the point of the movie. And I think it's part of the character. It's part of this character that we're being shown in this movie. Early on, his partner tells him, "You wouldn't put a gun to your head. You're not that kind of guy." And that's true. But he does, I think, drink the radioactive milk and infect himself deliberately before deciding to do the what he does at the end.
But why would he do that and risk not finishing off this vendetta? Like, he may die.
I think he's turned it over to the senator. That's when he then finds out that the milk is radioactive, and then it cuts away. And then he starts getting sick. We see him vomiting.
But he doesn't trust the senator, and he knows the senator's probably in on it. So why would
hasn't he also sent the stuff to the I love it, the ridiculous character of the reluctant newswoman who sort of apologizes.
Oh, the Fox News woman.
Yeah. So hasn't he
Fox
sent
News
that stuff off?
Are the heroes.
See, I think that's his backup plan. His primary plan is that the senator will do the right thing. His backup plan is that he sends the stuff, and I think he kills himself. So I think, Dingus, I'm sorry to shout you down, but I think, Dingus, that it's a crucial point, and it's one of the reasons that I think I like the movie. Now, maybe they weren't going for that, and I'm just reading that into it. But I don't think you get – clearly the idea was that Danny Houston developed something that was mirroring this radiation poisoning case in London. I think that's the sort of the zeitgeist that was being drawn from. And I think that's the idea here, that they poisoned the daughter. And the question that was asked by Dennis O'Hare was, can there be collateral damage? Can the father also be poisoned by the method of delivery? And then Danny Houston basically says yes. So I think that's the poisoned milk. If he drinks the milk, he will be poisoned.
You're saying he drinks it after he runs the Geiger counter? Or
yeah, what? Yeah. I think he knows it's – yeah, I think so.
And they just don't bother to show us this. In a movie this ham-handed, they don't bother to show us that he's actually done
it. It's a reveal. It's a reveal. I mean, no.
You are so far gone. Okay, it's fine that you come up with this and you can shout me down as much as you want to on it. But this is just too far beyond. I'm sorry.
Well, if he drinks the milk, that is a big deal, and it should be in the movie, Tom.
Yeah, if you get this from the original television series, and if you want to tell me that's what happens there, that's fine. But there's no evidence in this film that that is what actually happens.
Well, Dingus
gets sick.
So you have to tell me how he gets poisoned. You have to tell me how he gets poisoned. Then
he doesn't. No, he doesn't have to. He's saying it's such sloppy storytelling; it could be anything. And the fact that we're arguing about it kind of does support Dingus's point. I think, like, if it's not that clear why he dies.
You have a film that is constantly poisoning people and then shooting them. Let's poison somebody and then send an assassin over to shoot them. And then he poisons Danny Houston and then he shoots him too. I mean, it's constantly doing these things that are meaningless.
Hold on, Dingus. Yes, it is sloppy at times, but the reason that the daughter gets shot is because she goes to see her father before the poison kills her. Like, it's a contingency plan. She's decided to go turn the stuff into her father. They know what she's going to do. So the assassins are sent. By the way, this was a recurring motif, and this, Dingus, I agree with you. Sometimes it's sloppy. All of the assassins in this movie, I kept waiting for the scene where somebody is going to tell Mel Gibson a crucial point of data, but before they can say it, they get killed. Instead, in this movie, every time someone comes to give him data, they succeed in giving it to him before they get killed. Every single assassin in this movie is too late.
Yeah.
Assassins.
So
I know. Well, for dramatic purpose. I mean, it's clearly – but I was so glad that they didn't do that tease where I have to tell you something. Meet me at the park at 2:30. And then Mel Gibson goes to the park and he sees the guy, and as he's going to get the data, the guy gets killed by a sniper. That never happened, which I was
glad. Well, it happened at the very beginning of the movie. That's what happens at the very beginning of the movie. She says, I should have told you this a long time ago.
Right.
I should have told you. And then she gets shot. So the thing starts the movie.
Well, that's the central tension of the movie. But what I'm saying, Dingus, is in a typical thriller, that's one of the scenes, that's one of the teases as the movie is going along. You know, it's that standard X-Files thing. I have something to tell you. Meet me. And then the person gets
I'm going to die.
Right.
After I give it to you.
But everybody delivers everything they need to deliver, and then they get killed.
You're right, almost to a ridiculous degree. That poor luggage store girl who says, I'm done, and then he asks her one more question. She says, now I'm done. And then she gets out of the car at the perfect moment to be run over.
That was a Final Destination cheat, too, because you know they both would have seen or heard the car.
That actually predates. Isn't that Meet Joe Black? Didn't Meet Joe Black
kill Brad Pitt
that way? I didn't either, but I know of it.
That would have been an accident. This is an assassin who times running her over with her being done with the conversation and getting out of the car. And this is the movie you think is smart enough for him to commit suicide.
Well, Dingus, why are you saying that – why is it necessarily a matter of being smart or stupid?
Because I don't think that the type of subtle touch you're talking about exists in the world of this movie.
What about Ray Winstone then? What about Ray Winstone?
Aberration?
You find out.
It's obvious he's going to die. He gets shot at the end, so it's okay he gets shot again because it's obvious he's going to die.
Well, he commits suicide.
This scene, yeah, well, obviously. But again.
So is that smart or stupid? Is that smart or stupid?
Well, his character is stupid.
Because the cop didn't have to shoot him. So that's not necessary.
Well, he knew the cop was going to shoot him.
Yeah.
That's another thing. I think he commits suicide just like Mel Gibson committed suicide. But Dingus is willing to accept one of these things because the movie is smart, but he refuses the other one because the movie is stupid. I don't understand.
There's no dumb in this movie, though.
There's plenty of dumb in the movie, but you can't simply dispute a plot point by writing the movie off as stupid.
No, I'm not willing to accept it as a smart thing because he's just taken place in a scene where he knows he's going to shoot the three guys and he sits there and talks to them for the whole scene anyway, and they have all of this dialogue, and then he stands up and he shoots the three of them. Why did you have the scene if you're going to shoot them? Why did you bother even talking to them? And then he walks out and he gets shot. So I'm just saying at that moment I just said, oh, we're supposed to feel okay about this as an audience because we know he's going to die. We like Ray Winstone, so it's okay that he just got killed.
Well, he's talking to himself, and he's making sure they're they deserve it.
Yeah, like he's sort of like, okay, I'm going to see what these guys are going to do. I mean,
he's going to commit suicide. There's no reason for any of this.
Yeah, there is. He has to kill them, and he has to.
Yeah, he's
to make his decision, make his peace with himself.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, Dingus went out spottier on them than the Winston one. Definitely.
Yeah, Dingus, as much as you insist that the movie is like stupid or ham-handed, and I agree with you at many points, there is some good writing and there is some good character development in this movie, and I don't understand why you're so reluctant to accept that that might be the case, that you want to write it all off as stupid or ham-handed. I mean, there's plenty of stuff, like the car murder, that's so ridiculous that the assassin waits and somehow magically knows the moment she's going to step out of the car and he achieves the right speed to hit her there. But that's stupid. I grant you, that's stupid. But I don't understand why you're so resistant to this concept of the two lead characters, the protagonist and the traditional antagonist, both committing suicide and being sort of foils to each other. I don't understand why you refuse to accept that the movie could possibly have that smart kernel to it. I mean, this is from, and I didn't know this until after I saw it, this is from a 6-episode BBC miniseries back in the 80s. So I don't doubt, you know, that there was some smart English dude writing this stuff before it turned
into... Yeah, Dingus, he's British, like Gary Whitta.
I wondered if it had to be from something British. And the reason I'm so resistant to it, Tom, is because there's so much for me that is false, that is awkward, and again, time and time again, I kept thinking there's no reason for this scene. There should have been a different scene here in its place. And it's hard for me to imagine that a film that gets this many scenes and this much dialogue wrong would have actually made this kind of subtle a choice. He's going to commit suicide and we're not going to show you. And we're not even going to really even do a flashback reveal, which this film does constantly, that it would try to sneak this under the radar. I think this is one of your, if you'll excuse me, your sort of hopes that there's more going on than there actually is. And so you're going to think that is true. But I am not willing to give this film the benefit of the doubt.
Well, it's not even a matter of the film. It's a matter of the one plot point. I don't know how he gets infected. I don't know, and it's weird because it is a huge plot point, but it clearly shows that he identifies the milk as poison. He is not sick at that point. It then clearly shows that he is going to use this poison to kill his daughter's murderer. You know, he knows what happens if you drink this poison. And by the way, I also love that imagery of forcing the poison down the killer's throat, and I love the fact that it's milk. You know, this liquid that comes from a mother to nourish a child. I mean, I loved that imagery.
Should have been breast milk, though.
No, I did too, Tom. And if he would have let Danny Houston live at the end, and he would have died at Danny Houston's feet, you've got me. At least there is some kernel of
Dingus,
intellect or
right. Dingus,
something
do you,
there.
Do you have that same criticism at the end of Hamlet, that Hamlet doesn't let the king live after forcing him to drink the poison?
Dingus, all Mel Gibson's characters are suicidal, so he had to have been suicidal.
It's the same thing in Hamlet. He kills Claudius even though he's given him poison.
Mad Max, Hamlet.
It's not the same thing. Will you stop
Payback,
it?
Lethal Weapon.
Well, it is the same thing, because you're saying, oh, it's not as poetic if he kills him.
Last Temptation
of Christ. He can shoot him. He can give him the poison. It's a gesture. You know, you do the gesture, and then you kill the guy.
There is no reason to poison him if you're going to shoot him in the neck. And they do this again.
Just like Hamlet. Okay. I hope you complain that loudly next time you see a production of Hamlet.
I hope you just wake up tomorrow and think, did I actually...
I'll just call this movie Hamlet. Yeah.
Okay, here's my favorite thing about...
You're going to rue the day you did that. Rue.
Ray Winstone's name in this movie is Captain Jetbird.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Jetbird.
They call him
Jetbird.
They call him by both names.
I'm going to
use Jetbird as my nom de plume this time.
That's going to be, from now on when I play Star Trek Online, my character's going to be Captain Jetbird.
his actual name isn't that, but it did sound
it
like
is.
Jetbird. The entire time I thought, Jetbird.
I know. Is that your code name? Is that like your undercover name?
Why you...
He's a captain?
Of what?
Well, I was sort of, you know, unfortunately, as much as I like Ray Winstone, I was prejudiced against him from the beginning in that silly deep throat scene. Because as soon as we have that basement, parking garage, whatever that scene is, with that greasy guy and Jetbird, all I could think of was, no, I don't want this scene. I want to discover the mystery with Mel Gibson's character. I don't want to have any of these other scenes with right. the conspiratorial types. I want to be taken along and only know as much as he knows. And instead we have this silly scene with these guys just, you know, having this, what might be skullduggery dialogue, but it just isn't as light-handed as that. It's horrible.
And here's what happened, Dingus. The reason, and I agree, I totally hear what you're saying. The reason is because Martin Campbell adapted this, because Martin Campbell directed the BBC series back in 1984.
Right.
He adapted this from a six-hour BBC series, which obviously had a lot of characters, what obviously happened is he wanted to cram in more than a two-hour movie could really accommodate very smoothly. So obviously in the miniseries, it was probably a lot of skullduggery with Jet Bird and whatnot. And he couldn't let go of that. And it's a shame because there could have been something different here and something more streamlined and more graceful, I agree. For instance, Dingus, what the heck was happening where they kidnap him, they chain him to a gurney in a basement, and then he gets out and goes back home. I mean, what did I just see? Was this the torture scene that got cut, or what? I was like, wait.
Well, I thought for sure we were going there for our standard fallacy of the talking killer scene, where Danny Houston would come in and would talk a whole lot, and then he would get away. But we didn't even have that.
I know.
You're exactly right. And I think that only bolsters my point, is that most scenes are meaningless in this movie. And he goes there, he beats up a guy, and then he runs away.
Well, I don't agree that it's most scenes, but there's definitely what this is fallout of trying to adapt a six-hour miniseries. I think there was a long sequence in the miniseries where he does get captured and all this stuff happens. And for some reason, Martin Campbell wanted to include some of that, but I have, and so here was another thing I was wondering, Dingus, is that when he was poisoned, did they kidnap him and did those doctors then poison him? But I don't think that's the case because he was already vomiting when his friend came over and turned him in, when his friend betrayed
him. The guy gets no payoff, remember?
Well, right. He starts doing his silly Mel Gibson cough when he's up in her room.
Right.
Sort of being pensive before J.O. Sanders comes over to say, I've sold you out, but I didn't need it.
So that's why I was thinking, well, is that when he got poisoned? But it's not. So there was nothing accomplished by kidnapping him briefly. And then he goes right back home, and the henchmen don't even think, they're hanging out while Danny Houston is sleeping in his pajamas or whatnot at his house there, instead of going to head off Mel Gibson going home. I mean, that whole sequence was like weird. I was like, what are you guys doing?
But Danny Houston has already intimated that he's been poisoned in this silly scene.
No, he
hasn't.
No, Dingus, you're definitely wrong there. And
okay,
I know for sure you're
wrong.
Well, because all Danny Houston is answering Dennis O'Hare. Dennis O'Hare says, is there any possibility of collateral damage from the delivery method of the poison? And Danny Houston says, yes, there is a possibility. Because they have to dance, or they do the weird dance around thing where nobody can say anything directly. But the only question that's answered is, could the father be poisoned by the same vector or whatever they call it?
Oh, okay.
Delivery method. But Danny Houston isn't saying that, yes, he's definitely been
poisoned. Well, why have that scene if he drinks the milk deliberately then?
Which scene? The kidnapping scene?
No, the scene where the bad guy... I thought every scene where the bad guys confer was ruining the movie.
I think it's a little bit of redundancy along with the Geiger counter on the milk.
But
like, the Geiger counter on the milk...
Okay.
I mean, that's the thing is, we don't know... We don't know how she's been poisoned. We don't know how this stuff was delivered to her yet. So they have to say, yes, it's something in the house. Yes, it's something that Mel Gibson has access to. And then that scene with the Geiger counter reveals that it is the bottle of milk. And even if he doesn't drink it, that's there so that we can have him forcing it down Danny Houston's mouth.
And meanwhile, she has a Geiger counter among her personal things, and she doesn't bother apparently to use it on any of her stuff.
No, she doesn't. No, she doesn't, Dingus. That stuff was with her boyfriend. That stuff was in the bag that her boyfriend gave to Mel Gibson and said, these are her personal things she left at my apartment.
Yeah, and I love those lines. It's, again, so clunky. He actually hands the bag to Mel Gibson and says, basically, these are her personal things, which is not something anybody would ever say.
Okay, that's clunky, but you're wrong about having a
Geiger counter. To her place and hear her personal things. But that the government or the bad guys talking to each other scenes, Kelly's exactly right about that. You have this awful, goofy post-helicopter scene where Dennis O'Hare gets in the
car and says... And they're very one-dimensional.
They're horrible. He says, I was never here. Do you know where you were? And then the next scene, they're in the guy's office.
I know. Why didn't they ride together? Yeah. I was like, can I get a ride with you guys? We're going to the same place.
Yeah. They couldn't have been that one-dimensional in the BBC series.
Well, right? The BBC series, so I don't know if you guys know this. The BBC series obviously didn't have – so here's another thing I liked about the movie. I liked the central plot, which we'll talk about in a minute. But in the BBC series, the plot had something to do with some weird environmental issues. It wasn't a nuclear weapon manufacturer.
Ironically, back in the day they did nuclear stuff, and now they do environmental.
No. It was nuclear testing and stuff, but it wasn't this idea of – it was nuclear testing and environmental issues. And even in the BBC series originally, the main character, Mel Gibson's character, is supposed to turn into a tree, and that's no lie. as they were producing this, it was gonna have some weird, it had more weird fantastical mystical elements. And at the very end, he's supposed to like turn into a tree and be assimilated into Gaia or something like that.
Like Aronofsky, huh, guys?
There you go, exactly.
Was he one of the Na'vi?
James Cameron would have loved it. I liked the central plot here that, the government sort of on the sly contracts a weapons company to manufacture a weapon that can be used to frame a jihadist group so that they can presumably invade another nation. Like, I was like, yes, the neoconservatives now, like the Bush administration, they're the mustache twirling villains these days.
Yeah. And Fox News saves the day with their reporter
really...
who comes 2 weeks later.
Who shows up?
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be here.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm so late.
A cameraman. Oh, yeah.
You go away, but give me your card so I can call you at the
it's
end
like
of the movie.
Joke at the end of the movie.
She was get so mail. Sheepish about it. She's a terrible reporter.
Yeah. She gives up instantly, and the cameraman lowers his camera. for shame.
So and here's
she
another
gets the discs, and she goes in and talks to her editor. Oh, these are discs. Look at these discs. And he's like, oh, discs.
Yeah.
And another thing too with the media, I love how, and this is so 1984. So when Mel Gibson decides to, call in a favor from the police and have the henchmen arrested, it's on the local news, and we get, I think there's three different people who find out about the event by watching the local news at the same time. And the first thing I'm thinking of is who watches local news anymore? The second thing is why, obviously the guys get arrested. They're going to call Danny Houston. You know, he's going to find out from them directly before, having to see it on the local news.
The cops are just...
I liked how many times they said in that local news report that the guys had been found with automatic weapons. Because first of all, the cop comes around the car and says, there's automatic weapons in there. And then in the news report, you hear there were automatic weapons. And they had automatic weapons. And apparently this is the only station on in Boston because everybody's watching this at the same time, including the dead boyfriend who they totally did his reveal wrong. They show the back of his head, and then they show the bullet wound, and then they show the front of his face with his eyes open. When clearly you show the front of his face with his eyes open watching the TV, and then you work around to the bullet wound.
Yeah.
But everybody's watching this show, and then in the next scene, Mel's like, I need to talk to the senator.
They never use the automatic weapons either. They just sit in their car, so they don't eat them, and they run people over. And well, maybe the one guy, the boyfriend, died from an automatic weapon.
No, it seemed like a neatly placed pistol shot to the right temple. Yeah.
Who killed the boyfriend, by the way?
Well, see, that it was either the henchman or the Serbian car assassin who drove into the river. I forget if the timeline works where it could have been the – because he mentions a Serbian, I think, that he hired to run over luggage lady.
But
you know who it has to be who killed the boyfriend?
No.
It has to be Ray Winstone.
Oh. Okay, I like that. I'm going with that. I have no idea why you would think that, but I like that. I'm going to stick with it.
Well,
oh, because
why.
There's a cigar. Wait, no? Why?
Here's why, and this is where I'm going to give the film far more credit and Mel Gibson far less credit, where one of the last lines he says in the silly – there's a silly basement scene that Mel Gibson has with the boyfriend, and there's this ridiculous shot from behind these clothes. While they're having the scene, the camera ominously goes up behind some coats. And
I don't think anyone's there. I think it's a fake out.
Well, one of the things that Mel Gibson says to him is everything is illegal in Massachusetts. And that line is parroted back to him by Ray Winstone when Ray Winstone is sitting there drinking a glass of wine by the water for some reason. And Mel Gibson says it's illegal to drink in, and Ray Winstone says.
Ah, very good, Dingus. Nope.
Massachusetts.
Dingus, you're not giving the movie more credit than, I mean, that's obvious. That's a very obvious thing. And that's, too bad this movie was stupid. They must have accidentally done that, because that's such a smart movie.
Except Mel Gibson doesn't even notice. Oh, geez.
Yeah, he does. Why did he thanks Ray Winstone for letting him live.
What?
He does. There's a line at the end of the movie. Thanks for letting me live. He says that to Ray Winstone.
I think it's at the end of that scene, actually. It's not really at the end of that movie.
Yeah. Hey, remember when I was saying before the podcast that every scene in Meet Dave made me want to see what happened after that scene, like in an Education? I really wonder what happened in the scene after the CEO asked Mel Gibson, so how's it feel when he loses his daughter?
See, the answer didn't
matter. And then they cut to him outside later in the sunshine.
You know what? I liked that weird cut because obviously you don't answer that question. You just excuse yourself. This guy's being weird and inappropriate.
You don't get that reaction, though? A reaction shot of Mel Gibson going, ugh.
You don't get a reaction shot of Mel Gibson going, why the fuck did this guy meet with me? She's a trainee slash intern, as if those are the same thing. She's a trainee slash intern, and the leader of the company knows exactly everything about her and has agreed to meet with me, and he doesn't even question that. And then there's that ridiculous question. Then he chases the guy down, gets in his car, when he points the gun at Danny Houston, and Danny Houston is acting, everybody in my theater was laughing. And then he says, how does it feel? And then he gets out of the car, and there's no reason for that scene either.
There's no investigation of any kind. Like, he doesn't get in trouble for...
Well, of course he doesn't, because Danny Houston's killed his daughter. I mean, Danny Houston, no. I mean, that's him telling to Danny Houston, I know that there's more to this than you're letting on.
Okay, the henchmen get on the local news by having automatic weapons in their car, but meanwhile, right? Nothing's on the news about these cars going into the water, people getting murdered in broad daylight, Mel Gibson pulling over.
You don't know that. These things are probably being very responsibly reported in the local news. We just don't see that part. I'm sure that stuff got coverage, obviously.
I hate you.
Let me just say this. I'm suspicious of almost anyone in a movie who listens to jazz records.
Why?
Unless it's Woody Allen.
Who listened to jazz in this movie? What are you talking about?
Well, the movie starts with Mel Gibson listening to a jazz actual vinyl record on his vinyl record player. And the one nice touch is when he goes to her apartment,
right,
and she has a record player, and he has this nice smile that happens.
See, you liked it.
But I still am suspicious of it just strikes me as the filmmaker likes this and he's sticking it in.
Well, it's from 1984, too. So
now, if you like jazz, it means you're a complex dude. So they're showing off that Mel's like a cultured man. Like, he's got a sense of the arts because he listens to jazz.
Right. Well, the cute touch is that you show the record player and the records.
Right.
And then you also show the laptop sitting on the old desk, which I think is a nice little bit.
Because laptops are culture, too, huh?
Well, it just shows that he's an old dude who still has a record collection, but he also uses a laptop.
Okay, here's the thing. So luggage lady is in his car. She gets out of the car and gets killed, and it knocks off his passenger door. He presumably – oh, by the way, she doesn't get killed because he drives her to the hospital, and we find out she's going to –
Oh, that's
she's
right.
Coma.
But
she
we doesn't can't get save killed. The leg.
So right. she's going to have a bit of a limp.
She's been stabilized, and she's in a coma, but we could not save the leg.
So he drives her straight – he drives her straight to the hospital and, you know, we have this little scene, and then he goes out to his car and pulls out his laptop and looks on the discs in the car. And the whole time I'm thinking, wait a minute, that car doesn't have a passenger door anymore. So he left his laptop in there, and that could have gotten stolen if you do that.
Well, he could have left it in the trunk, and they just didn't show.
Ah, good point.
The coverage you were talking about earlier, they didn't show.
Well, they also don't show the door. I thought that maybe at some point we were going to get to see him driving his crippled, doorless car. You know, does he duct tape some clear sheeting over that side? Or I was wondering, what is he going to do without a passenger side door? But we don't get to see that.
Does he ever drive in that scene after that?
He seems to have a few. He has his own car. He seems to appropriate police cars a few times. Like, he's got his work car, and then he's got his drive to work car. So, Yeah. I wasn't real clear on the whole vehicle rotation in this movie.
Does he have any other cases going on? Is he still working at this police station?
I think so. Yeah.
Well, there's this weird, really ham-handed thing of where they keep saying
Dinkus, it's... that's enough. You've used up your weekly appropriation for using the word ham-handed, so that's it. Go ahead.
Go ahead and give me a synonym I can use. Steak paw.
Ham-fisted. Totally different.
Hot dog. There's a weird ham-handed scene at the police station, you were going to say.
Well, no, it's this dialogue that a couple of them say, this is a cop thing, officer involved.
Right,
yeah.
Which is, you know, why are you
New
telling
rules.
Him this? You're telling us this, that's right. And then they have this scene with the captain or whatever, where they do an end run around why Mel Gibson can't be involved in it. And Mel Gibson does this gobbledygook of how, yes, I can be involved because I want to be paid for it. And the captain goes, he's right, isn't he? But this one little technicality, which I was actually interested in finding out about, they totally gloss over, but they keep saying it's a cop thing, officer involved. And so I kept wanting them to say in the early scene when he's already sitting after his daughter's been murdered and the cops are all in the house and he's already got his Mel Gibson revenge face on instead of some sort of grieving face. He's got this revenge face on and J.O. Sanders comes in. There's some sense that he might be a head case and
mm-hmm. And then he hears voices.
He's not a head case. Don't worry about it. But I thought that maybe he's on leave for some reason because of some psychological problems, but they never chase any of this down, and there's not really a sense that he has other cases.
Well, I never got the sense that he was on leave. But why couldn't he have been an active duty policeman whose daughter just happened to be visiting him?
And now he's on leave because of her death.
Well, he certainly could be that, but who's his partner? What are the other things that are pressing down on him?
Oh, good Lord.
He just decides, I'm just going to go off on my own and do this.
The thing is, his daughter gets killed in the first reel, and you want us to go into the workaday details of his career?
Just to throw away. I kind of agree with Dinkus. I want to know
Well, it really does. I liked how abruptly it began. You know, okay, the chick's visiting. You know, we get some sort of mandatory scenes between the two of them. I mean, obviously, he keeps his badge and his gun in the kitchen. He's not retired or anything.
He's just retarded.
And then she gets like abruptly killed. I mean, that's the movie jumps right into the, you know, let's have him be a bereaved father cop, bereaved
right,
cop
right,
dad.
Right. I got no sense that he was part of, and they kind of explain this away by him saying he's not a joiner, but I got no sense that he's part of that brotherhood. And it's nice that they constantly refer to that. They say, you know, you've got all these brothers, we can help you out.
And they do help
referring to that.
He does end up recruiting them. Like he gets their help when he wants those henchmen put in jail, which I'm not sure what that accomplished, by the way.
No,
nothing.
I'm sure.
What about when he tells them all to get out of his house at the beginning while they're conducting the murder investigation of his daughter, and then they all just leave?
And they don't
get out, and then they go, oh.
And he doesn't have to go downtown to get processed. And then please explain to me why he has to go ID the body that he's been found holding.
I think that's a formality. That's how the real cops do it.
If he wanted to.
That is pathetic. If you know, if that's actually a formality, please don't show it to me because he's been,
you just got finished, Dinkus, wanting to see what his other caseload.
Yeah, this is what he has to do every day. He has to identify his daughter's body.
No, I just wanted some sense that he was actually a cop or that he was on a leave or something.
He was an actual cop.
That he just breezes through whatever he wants to breeze through. And then we have this ridiculous scene where you have to go down and ID the body. Really, he was found there holding the body. It's not like she's a Jane Doe. And if that's an actual procedure, it's the only reason it's there is so he can just say, do you have some scissors so I can clip a piece of hair all of a sudden? There's no other way
that'll
you can
radiate
have that.
Me. Tom?
I can't believe I'm stunned that you're defending this movie so staunchly, Tom.
Oh, I fully agree. I liked it. I fully agree that there were some very clumsy things in it, and I think that it was the result of it being distilled down from a 6-hour miniseries. But all I'm saying is that I liked it, and the things that bother you seem to me a little pedantic, which is fine if that's sort of the approach you want to take. And I agree that some of them are problems. But I'm defending is that I liked it.
Okay, that's fine. You can like it just fine. But
from my point of view, you haven't given me a reason why you like it.
Okay, well, I thought I had, but I liked that it wasn't, as Kelly said, slappy. I liked how sort of morose and somber it was. I liked the things that it did differently. I liked the parallels between, and I liked Ray Winstone's characters and Mel Gibson's characters as foils, rather than the traditional guys fighting each other. I liked that we never had that scene between the two of them. I find Danny Houston to be wonderfully creepy and weird, so I liked seeing him as the villain. I liked the overall plot, as I was saying, about, you know, they're going to have a company create a bomb that they can use as a reason to invade another country. I liked some of the scenes with Mel Gibson, and I agree with Kelly, playing against type rather than playing angry, cool, badass, payback dude. I liked him being more somber, more morose, and just I liked the talky scenes. I liked how there weren't a lot of, like, gunfights and shootouts. I like the reveal that he's obviously a cop who knows what he's doing when he has... I like the fight with the boyfriend. You know, they're both out of... They trashed that apartment. I loved that. And they're both out of breath afterwards. I enjoyed that. It wasn't like an action movie thing where they, you know, they punch each other and then they're fine and they're talking.
But they may as well have not fought because it has no effect on events. Fights should always matter, too.
Well, so they didn't fight. I mean, the fight was simply to disarm to take the knife away from the kid.
That doesn't matter. That's not
they weren't trying to punch each other. I mean, they weren't trying to, like the kid was...
A misunderstanding.
Right, it's a misunderstanding, and Mel Gibson uses this, we see, yeah, he's a cop who knows how to fight. He uses his training to disarm the kid, and then we go into the exposition. We go into more talky stuff.
And you're exactly right, Tom, that both characters are aware when after Mel Gibson has him on his back, on his stomach, and he's got his hands behind his back, and he says, Mr. Burnham, I'm not going to hurt you. Both actors are aware, okay, now we are moving into the exposition. And that scene is a perfect representation of why this movie didn't work for me, because Mel Gibson has no idea who this guy really is. This guy could have murdered his daughter, and he just gets off of him and just assumes everything's fine, and everybody assumes everything's fine. I'm not going to hurt you. Okay, let's just go on with the scene. They've had this scene where they've beaten each other up, and then they just move on from it.
I think they have not beaten each other up. The kid was obviously paranoid and scared about something. He's got the knife. He's going to use it, and Mel Gibson disarms him and then proceeds to question him and doesn't get much information from him.
No.
He just finds out that the kid is scared, that the kid won't talk because of stuff about where they worked, that the kid thinks he's being watched, and that he's not going to get any more information out of him, so he gives him the card.
Mel Gibson has no reason to assume that this is just a scared kid and not the kid who murdered his daughter. And instead of that, he holds the guy's hands behind his back, says, I'm not going to hurt you, and then they move on with the scene.
Why would he assume that the guy murdered his daughter?
Because he tries to shoot at him, and he doesn't know him at all.
He tries to shoot at who? What are you guys talking about?
It's the kid. The boyfriend tries to shoot Mel, and that's
no, he doesn't. He has a knife. He does not try to shoot Mel Gibson.
Stab, shoot, whatever. You know.
But the kid, I'm not understanding what you guys want. I'm explaining that I liked that fight scene. I understand that there was a lot of exposition here. If you didn't like it, that's totally cool. I got a little bored with some of it. But Dingus was asking why I liked the movie, and one of the things I liked was that fight scene, was how they trashed the place, how it was clear that the kid was just scared, and Mel Gibson was just trying to disarm him and not hurt him, how throughout the conversation afterwards they were both out of breath. Those were details that I enjoyed in that scene.
Mark Campbell does action scenes.
He really does, and that's the thing. I loved the sequences.
He's a good action director.
The driving sequences, even when they weren't necessarily a chase scene, I really liked in this movie. The way that he shot Mel Gibson driving through traffic. He is a good action director.
But there's too many anticlimax scenes where he does have – there is a fight, and then they wind up just talking and leaving each other, and nothing happens. He's with the boyfriend. He does it with the henchman. It happens like four or five times.
Well, the henchman he just runs away from. I was sort of And
my point is that both of those action sequences you're talking about are in the service of nothing. So that I liked the fight with the boyfriend in the apartment, but it leads to a scene where they're both just saying, "Okay, well, we have to move on with the scene now. I'm not going to hurt you." Okay. And then the car chase scene, which is not even a car chase, it's just him driving through traffic, ends in a scene where he punches a driver, threatens Danny Houston with a gun, and then walks away. And
no, I wasn't talking about that scene. I was talking about other scenes, like the first scene where he's driving. There's a couple of driving scenes.
Well, what incredible driving scene are you talking about, other than the one where he escapes the guys in the big black truck?
bang out a restroom window loudly that they don't hear.
He bangs out a restroom, and it takes them 5 minutes to get, you know, because they're 30 feet behind him. Then he drives crazily through traffic to catch up with Danny Houston's car, pull him over, punch his driver out, put his gun to his head, say, how does it feel, and then walk away. What other sequence?
There had been other driving scenes earlier in the movie. Let's see where – I don't remember where he was going. Like I said, it wasn't a chase. There was another great driving scene. Was it even just where he was going to work after she'd been murdered? Anyway, I don't – but it wasn't a chase. It's just that Martin Campbell gets the camera down in thick traffic. It doesn't look like, okay, we've cleared the road. We're going to have a couple of desultory cars around.
Okay.
I like the resolution with Danny Houston. I like the resolution with all the main characters.
I agree with you that he handles the action sequences great. And I agree with you. I love that fight in the apartment. I love how they're just throwing things. I love how the boyfriend throws something from the stove and it turns out to be just like a bag or something. And he's just trying to throw things, and Mel Gibson turns over the table but misses the guy. I think the fight scene is very, very good.
I liked Danny Houston, what he could do with the wedding ring. Did you guys catch that little bit of business?
His little thing where, you know, some actors can dance a coin on their fingers. He does that with his wedding ring.
Yeah.
I like that. I agree.
I like the opening shot. I like the whole, aspect of that. And then later on seeing,
what, the bodies in the water that we never find out about?
We do find out. Those are the three environmental activists that had been poisoned and then dumped in the river.
Oh, okay, that's good then.
I like the senator because he reminds me of the voice of Shere Khan from Jungle Book, which I just saw with my son recently.
That guy was weird looking. I didn't know if they were going for a Barney Frank thing there or what. I was like, is this the gay senator from Massachusetts? What's the deal with that guy? He didn't look like any senator I've ever heard of. I liked the absurdity. There were times during the movie that I laughed out loud, like the absurdity of the newswoman scene. I was just like, what the? And even the escape. Like, once he gets in the car, when I realized after he'd been kidnapped, and then rather than doing something drastic, he just goes home, I laughed at that. It's like, okay, whatever.
That's in character for him, though. He's just like, whatever, let him try.
I really liked Ray Winstone's doctor. I like that scene, even though I'm not convinced that Ray Winstone's character should be in there, where Ray Winstone begins the scene by saying, do you see a soul in there? And he keeps trying to talk to the doctor, and the doctor finally says, I know you want me to banter. I can only give you
that. Yes.
I loved that, I know you want me to banter, because it really felt true to what was going on in the rest of the movie. I know you want me to banter, but I just can't do that for you. And then Ray Winstone had to sort of walk away. It felt like sort of as if somebody had said to Anton Chigurh, I'm not going to flip the coin. You're going to have to go somewhere else. And he would just go, okay, I have to do that.
I wasn't crazy. So let's talk performances real quick before we move on. I love Ray Winstone. And I just was not crazy about what he was doing here. I wasn't convinced that it really worked.
That's the script.
I don't know. I mean, he was he doing a Hannibal Lecter-y kind of thing? I don't know.
What is he thinking?
Maybe. It just seemed like
less. Which means he's a good guy, because if he was a bad guy, he would just shoot Mel Gibson. He would just string him along for the whole movie unless he was good.
And how about Mel Gibson's accent? What did you guys think of that?
I liked it. He's just an Australian who migrated.
I want to relate a quick anecdote. When I was doing acting stuff, I got called in for an audition once, and so I get the sides, and the sides are what you call the pages from the script that have just that scene, and there's no other details. And the scene was about a guy who works in a mailroom in a company, and something happens with the guy, and he gets frustrated, and he takes a gun and holds some people hostage, and it becomes like a standoff scene. And the guy was apparently like retarded, I think. And I remember getting the sides for this and thinking, wow, this is like, I've done little things on TV and none of it I would consider real acting or performance. But this would have been like a real performance thing, because it's like a retarded guy who
that's not performing for you.
Who flips out, thank you. Who flips out and holds people hostage. So I go in to do the scene, and you know, I try to memorize the script, and I go in to do the scene, and it's for a casting director who'd used me and stuff before. So I kind of knew the guy, and I start reading the scene with his assistant, and I'm doing my, you know, I'm not going full retard, but I'm doing, like, the guy's obviously slow, he's a little retarded, and I'm doing the scene, I do a couple of lines back and forth with the casting director's assistant, and the casting director stops me and says, Tom, whatever you're doing, that's interesting, but don't do that. And that's what I was thinking watching, you know, Mel Gibson's, like, weird nasal Boston accent. No, whatever you're doing, that's interesting, but don't do that.
There were a couple of moments that reminded me either of the Three Stooges or of a kind of a, yeah, she.
Like, it's
we're
going to
have a nice
plate
of spaghetti. Yeah, that's what I do, yeah. I want to ask you something, Tom. You just triggered something in my memory. The very first the movie opens after the body's burbling up with a home video at the beach, mm-hmm. and you can really hear his Australian accent in the voiceover for that. Let me know if you strike oil or something like that. And I want to ask you, what do you think of the use of the home video with relation to just the actual girl being in scenes with him? The actual little girl. What do you? Can you give me a feel for how you felt about that?
Well, what I feel, again, this is my guess is that this was a casualty of a 6-hour miniseries being adapted to a 2-hour movie. My guess is that the miniseries, the title of the miniseries, Edge of Darkness, refers to the state of the world with the threat of nuclear war. Mel Gibson, you know, or that character, and his grief leading to suicide. And Ray Winstone and that character being terminally ill, that they're all three, those two characters in the world are on the edge of darkness. And part of the darkness for Mel Gibson's character, Tom Craven, I think is his name, is that he's gradually going a little crazy, you know, that he's hearing his daughter's voice, that it's haunting him, that he's seeing her, you know. So if that's what you're asking about, I think that was probably a major theme in the miniseries, is that he's constantly visited by the specter of his daughter. Is that what you mean?
That's kind of what I mean, but I want you to also address this intermittent use of home movies with that. Do you know what I mean? Every so often there,
right?
The film started with this, like, time code, we're watching a home movie, and then you would have what you're talking about, like with the shaving scene,
right?
And then a couple of times with suddenly the home movie. Does that mean anything to you? Does that do anything for you? Do you think it should have been one or the other, or is that fine?
Was he actually, like, for some reason in my head, I mean, I remember those home movie scenes, but was he not, like, isn't the idea that he's watching home movies of his daughter?
Well, there's no establishing shot. There's no sense of that. It's just,
the home movie
I guess this is in his head too. And so then we wind up with him out in the water, like doing that tossing the ashes thing. And I just don't know where to put those home movies. If you're going to have the home movies and you're going to have the actual presence of her, I think you choose one or the other, or you establish the home movies, because I didn't understand it. And I wanted to hear, since you liked the movie and you liked what it's going for, I really wanted to hear what you had to say about that.
Yeah, it just didn't register for me. I mean, it was obviously these are, you know what? It's like in Carriers. In Carriers, there are home movies, but we never see the characters playing the home movie and watching them. The home movies just represent them replaying memories in their head. And that works in Carriers, and I didn't object to it here. I guess what you're going for is that it's ham-handed, because we don't actually see him watching.
I would not say ham-handed, because I've used up...
Steak-fisted. So, I don't know. All right. So, there you go. How about that?
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3.
I could talk about Edge of Darkness all night, and how awesome it is.
We just did.
I could too. Yeah, that was a Legion joke.
All right, so this week's 3x3, I believe that's yours, Dingus. Take it away. What do you got for us?
This is your three favorite or three great uses of the F word.
Hmm.
That's my favorite fucking word. Wait, which one?
I think I go first because I inherited the 3x3 this week. I'll be throwing one down later. My third favorite is a period piece. It is an interesting Steven Soderbergh experiment. It wasn't entirely successful, but it was shot in the style of like 40s melodramas called The Good German. Not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but there's, you know, it comes from a very different time. It's set in 1945. It's American GIs stationed in Berlin, while they're reconciling how everything's going to get set up with the Russians and with Germans trying to escape the country and whatnot. And at one point, George Clooney, who's playing a general who's investigating a murder, something he's trying to do gets stymied, and he says, "F a duck." which is such a cute little period thing, and it was just a throwaway line. It didn't really mean anything, but I was just so charmed by that.
But you're not going to say the F word when you're quoting the movie?
I'm not, no. And that's a shame, too, because it rhymes. I mean, and that's part of the charm of that idiom, and I wish that was in heavier rotation these days. F a duck. So
why aren't you saying it?
I don't generally cuss. You know that.
Hmm. You mm-hmm. cussed in one of the game podcasts. Just
I know. God, Troy told me I was Troy told me I was the first one to roll the F word out on the podcast I do on strategy gaming called Three Moves Ahead, which I didn't realize, and that's true. I'll say it here. I'm going to say it for you guys. Fuck a duck.
Yes,
I just love that. Yes. So there you go. That's my number three favorite uses of the F word. Kelly Wand, I believe you're second.
I see now why you weren't cast as the retarded guy. Because you're a loose cannon. My number three, I'm going to say before someone else snakes it, is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Did they cuss in that?
Oh, really?
You don't remember? I don't remember. I don't know. What?
Steve Martin goes to see the car rental agent, played by Edie McClurg of Ferris Bueller fame. She goes, "How may I help you?" And he goes, "You can start by wiping that fucking dumbass smile off your rosy fucking cheeks. Then you give me a fucking automobile, a fucking Datsun, a fucking Toyota, a fucking Mustang, a fucking Buick, four fucking wheels and a seat."
Wow, that's awesome. That's Steve Martin?
Yeah.
Why is he so mad?
Because John Candy's been screwing him the whole movie. He's getting stuck in places. He says it like 90 times after that. And then
he's also pissed that we didn't choose that movie for our weather one.
Oh, does weather stymie their cross-country trip? Is that the whole point there?
Yeah. They're in the back of a truck at one point, and he goes, "What's the temperature?" And John Candy goes, "1. That's pretty funny. You don't remember the car rental agent scene?
I probably saw it once as a kid, and that movie didn't...
It's the most times anyone says the F word, I think, in any movie. In a short... Right. In that short a span that I can think of.
I totally remember, Kelly, because I was trapped with only that movie and one other movie on VHS for an entire summer, and so I basically got that movie memorized, so that's a really good choice.
Isn't that movie, one of the things I do remember about that movie is being just a matter of just time after time, terrible bad things happening to the characters. They're constantly being stymied, and I think I vaguely remember it being just kind of... overbearing by the time it was over. Just like I felt like I'd been beat down. And I don't know, maybe that's not an accurate...
That's acceptable subject matter for a comedy, though. It's the most irritable man in the world and the most irritating man in the world.
That's like who wins with an unmovable force and...
Yeah, and the weather's conspired against him, and then there's a crappy, sappy, happy ending. Yappy, slappy, happy.
Oh, excuse me. I got it wrong. It's an irresistible force and an unmovable object. So
it's immovable. Wait, what'd you say? The first time?
An irresistible force meets an unmovable object. That's the principle that I was your thing with the most irritating man and the most irritable man in the world.
Right.
But if you look at that sort of that feeling of being beaten over the head from the point of view of how John Candy reacts to it, as opposed to how Steve Martin reacts to it, the film starts to take on a different kind of feel.
Okay. Is that John Hughes?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. I should watch that.
He made a movie with grown-ups in it.
I should watch that then in commemoration. Okay. Dingus, what is your number three use of the F word?
All right. My number three use of the F word is going to start with my most obvious one. And the reason I I use the F word today, and that would be the film Die Hard. And that would be the quote, yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. It's obvious, but I made reference to the fact that I was trapped for an entire summer with only two movies. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was one of them, and Die Hard was the other. And I was in a dry county in Prestonsburg, Kentucky, doing theater. Summer theater, and I've mentioned this before in this podcast. And so I watched Die Hard and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles over and over and over and over and over again. And I love this word. I love the F word.
I do too. I think it's cool one of and my, funny.
It's one of my favorite words, and I was brought up not saying it and not allowed to say it. Both by my parents and my church and myself. I didn't feel I would ever be able to say this word. And I didn't cuss at all when I was in, almost at all when I was in college, and people used to make fun of me for that. And in fact, at the end of this summer, I got, you know, when the theater gave their little cast awards, I got the, I got some kind of award, the gosh darn it, shoot, whatever the substitutes were for bad words that I was using. It was like the what the heck, shoot, gosh darn it award, because I refused to use the actual words. But I so wanted to. And Die Hard came along, and there's no way, and I love movie quotes so much, there's no way to quote a movie like that without saying fuck.
Well, you're wrong, Dingus, because the fourth movie managed to do that.
Right. I would have had to shoot myself every time I wanted to say the F word.
Well, that's what happens in the fourth movie. Bruce Willis has to shoot himself to cover the actual F word.
Right, but I can't shoot myself in the shoulder that amount of times. And so this movie, finally wanting to say yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, got me over the hump of not saying the F word. And this was a huge moment in my life. It sounds pretty ridiculous.
Die Hard taught you to cuss, and it taught me to smoke.
Oh no, I forgot that.
Kelly Wan, what did Die Hard teach you to do? I don't want to know. Actually.
Hack computers so I can blow up hot ATVs.
So Dingus, that's actually my number two pick is Die Hard, and not just Die Hard, but the way that it's evolved through the series. It is so appropriate in the first movie because he's saying it actually to Hans Gruber. I mean, he's telling him, you know, he's been accused of being a cowboy. So that's where the yippee-ki-yay comes from. And then the mother effer is the sort of the icing on the cowboy cake, as it were. It's a great little package. You know, at times when one-liners were so like glib and Schwarzenegger, I mean, this is this clever little package delivered to the bad guy. I loved that. But then things happened to it. So in the second movie, nobody hears him say it. He says it to himself in the snow when he drops the lighter in the trail of fluid to blow up the airplane. Nobody's around. It's like if a tree falls in the woods, does anybody hear it? If a one-liner is delivered alone in the snow, is there any point? You know, he's talking to himself. And I don't remember, I'll be curious if you guys remember, I don't remember the third one, but in the fourth one, of course, as we alluded, because it was PG-13, he eclipsed, you know, he got mother out, but by the time the F word came out, it was covered by the sound of the gunshot when he's shooting the bad guy. Right. So what happened to it in Die Hard 3? Do you guys remember?
He says it.
Like ad nauseum over and over? Is it just once?
He says it once at the end when he shoots a helicopter. Or
Jeremy Irons, right?
Wire. Yeah.
But what is this about the rating? Is that why they drop it?
Yeah.
PG. Well, what was Die Hard 13?
Once you're 14, you can hear people.
Oh, Dingus! All the Die Hards are R-rated. I mean, that was one of the cool things about Die Hards is that they were R-rated action movies.
Yeah,
even the last one, Die Hard.
No. That was PG-13.
That was the shark jump.
Well, yeah.
I would say it was a shark jump. It was PG-13. You couldn't have a lot of blood. And
PG-13 is a shark jump for any action movie. You heard me.
But they got him. I mean, that's purely an economical decision because more people are going to go. I should say fewer people are going to be able to go to an R movie.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's sort of the controversy is, okay, therefore we have a gunshot mask the F word for the economic realities of movies these days. We're going to have a big franchise movie. Bruce Willis is going to cost a lot of money, and we can't afford to not let teenagers go see it. So therefore, there goes the F word part of that wonderful line. So that's
which I don't get, because if you're 17, you can take anyone into the movie, take a baby into an R-rated movie. That's the rule. That's the law.
When I went to see Legion, a woman rolled in a stroller with a baby.
No.
Yeah, swear to God. Yep.
I could not believe it.
Yeah.
That movie does have a positive baby image.
That's true. The baby does almost accomplish something. So, in Die Hard 3, out of curiosity, does Jeremy Irons hear Yippee-ki-yay, mother effer?
No. Stop saying effer. It's so distracting.
Effa-doc.
Because everyone, you hear it in your head, and it's like, oh, he's saying F.
You know what? I'm just getting warmed up, Kelly. You wait till my number one pick.
I'm the repressed one around here.
Yeah, no shit.
All right, Kelly Wan, so what's your number two favorite use of the F word?
My number two.
Wait a minute.
What?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, because mine is Die Hard 2. I mean, it's also Die Hard.
Yours is the Die Hard series, isn't it?
I picked Die Hard.
Then it was good. I don't like swearing.
I love swearing. I love it. I just, I'm very
excited. Hi, mother effer. That's acceptable dialogue. Candy cigarettes.
What the TV edits are, because it is, what is it, Melon Farmer?
It's Mother Father.
No, I think it's Melon Farmer. I think Dix is right. Yippee-ki-yay, Melon Farmer.
Remember the first time you heard someone say freaking, like on an edited for TV telecast? You went, what? That's never going to catch on. And now people say it.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Yippee-ki-yay, Mother Freaker.
Mother Freaker.
All right, Kelly, what's your number
that's
two?
So much less sick sounding, isn't it?
Mother Freaker.
I hate that. I hate the how we've strayed from the F words. I don't know. It's a satisfying word.
It's a wonderful word, yes.
Say it as much as possible, I think. No, they'll get sick of it, and they won't say it anymore.
It's a wonderful word, and one of the wonderful things about it is it has its place. Like, it belongs in very specific places. And I personally believe that in mixed company or speaking to an audience like we're doing, it's just for me. I don't pass judgment on anyone else, but I don't really feel that's an appropriate place for it. So, I'm not trying to be sanctimonious. It's just sort of how I personally feel.
Wait, what do you also feel? An appropriate place? A podcast? Oh,
no. With friends, I use it. I mean,
what's the inappropriate place?
Addressing an audience of people who you don't necessarily know personally.
Hmm. It's not only that. Tom has a real, I would say, Southern sensibility as far as women are concerned, and he is far less likely to use off-color language in front of a female. And he looks down, not looks down, but
are you
gently,
saying he marries them at the point of a shotgun?
No, he's it's really actually quite
he's
charming.
Courtly.
He doesn't like that kind of language used in front of women or girls, and I really like that about him.
But no girls listen to this thing, except Tom's
I know,
sister.
But
and I think actually that's the point. Tom.
Well, you know what? That's not. I mean, my sister listens. My mother listens. I've got a very close friend from high school, named Kelly. Hi, Kelly, if you're listening, she listens. So we have some women listening. And it's not like I'm not hung up about it. Like I said, I love the word and I use it. And I used it. I said fuck a duck and I enjoyed it.
Uh-huh.
Oh guy. Oh dang you, Kelly Wand.
It's not that you're hung up.
You just lost all our female listeners because they don't believe in it. Kind of thing.
It's not that you're hung up. It's just that you have a sense of decorum and it's something I really like.
Thank you.
No. No, you don't.
Kelly Wand, what is your number two favorite use of the F word?
I will do the quote, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it.
That's fine. But like I said, wait till we get to my number one.
I don't have a sister or a mom. I do have a mom.
Sugarcoated.
She is. That sounds dirty too, doesn't it? Everything does. Okay. Name this movie. Fuck me. Let Jesus fuck you.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a tough one, huh?
The Exorcist?
Ah. Yeah. Come on, that's good. That was the first time I ever heard that.
Oh, that is very good. Wow.
The Exorcist. Yeah.
That didn't really occur to us.
The Exorcist does. I mean, that's
and
true.
She's doing
she's
violating herself with a crucifix, so it's even sicker than just saying the F word.
Well, it really does. I mean, the demon in The Exorcist is more than happy to use perverted sexuality to be provocative to the priest. I mean, your mother sucks seas in hell. That's the really famous profane line from The Exorcist because, and it's terrible to say,
Seize candy?
Yeah.
That's terrible to say because you can't hear that without you know, there's a mental image there, like that paints something in your head.
Don't do that. Stop that.
See, I made you think it, Dingus.
That was rude.
And that's what the demon does to.
I take back what I said about decorum.
But no, The Exorcist was very, I mean, the demon's use of profanity in The Exorcist was fantastic, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was groundbreaking.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why all people fainted. But the Catholic types loved that movie.
Well, it's a movie about fate. I mean, I maintain that any good horror movie isn't just to scare you. I mean, good horror movies.
So it's ironic that the first time we ever heard the F word was like the most religious movie ever.
Well, it's not the first time we ever heard the F word, is it? I mean, Midnight.
When did I did.
Oh, right.
Midnight
right.
What?
I was going to say Midnight Cowboy. Isn't that like one of the early movies that violated all these rules about cussing and whatnot? Is that before The Exorcist?
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe it was just gay sex. Maybe that's what Midnight Cowboy introduced.
It also introduced I'm Walking Here.
Yes, it did.
I'm comfortable with the word violated when we talk about this.
It's an uncomfortable scene. You're supposed to be uncomfortable. That's what William Friedkin wanted. And you know, by the way, the television edit, your mother knits socks in hell.
Really?
That's true. Yep.
Huh. And then that makes him mad.
Ooh.
Are you making that up? My mom's a sock knitter.
Might be apocryphal, but I have heard that, Dingus. I have not verified that.
How could there possibly be a television edit of
mother
the extra
socks in hell? I got to say that to somebody. I totally possess something now. Thanks.
In the TV edit, she spits applesauce instead of pea soup.
Yeah.
What's your number two, Dingus? What do you got for us? Number two favorite use of the F word.
All right. My number two is nothing groundbreaking like Kelly Wan just chose, which what a great. I didn't even think of The Exorcist.
I didn't think of Die Hard, and you guys both did. So.
This is nothing special or elegant. I just love the exchange. So let me do the whole exchange and don't guess and don't jump in.
Oh, is it one that I can do with you?
I don't think so.
What about what's his name?
No, it's not that. But nice.
Oh, guy. Rats! Could we do that right now? Are you up for it?
I'm certainly not. I'm not off book for that right now.
It's got an F word. It ends with an F word. Oh, it's not the one you're going to pick. You should pick that one, Dingus. Change your
answer. No, I want to go back and pick it. Can you stop and we'll go back and do that?
we're talking about With Nail and I. What the fuck? That's a great line. Oh, I want to change mine now.
Okay. Yeah, me too. We should do a back and oh crap.
All right, do your exchange, Dingus. Man, right. There's great F words in With Nail and I. Oh.
Yeah, I missed that movie. It's been too long since I've seen it.
You should see that once or twice a year, easily.
Yeah, it's good shit.
All right, Dingus, how's that for a tough act to follow? I hope we've just ruined you. What do you got that's better than With Nail and I?
Which none of us chose. Thanks. Well, this is not going to be better. It's nothing special. I just love the way it's used in this movie. And so here's the exchange. You're starting to put words in my mouth. Jack, you're a grown man. You have control of your own words. You're goddamn right. And I do so. Here come two words for you. Shut the fuck up.
Midnight
I knew
Run.
You. Yeah, I knew that he would do something from Midnight Run. I could have guessed that. That's right. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That is a good one.
You undersold it.
Yeah, well. I saw this, you know, again, I'm doing the sort of more about me than about the movie thing. But I saw this when it was out in theaters with my dad, and he was really quite embarrassed afterward about all the language in it. And it was funny to hear him say that he was really uncomfortable with that. And both my parents are really uncomfortable about that kind of language used in films, especially my mom. But to hear my dad say that and really get sheepish about it was pretty funny. And this was, again, really before I started using the F word in conversation. Not that I do if I'm not just among the guys. But
you've replaced it with the N word.
Yeah, right. That's what I do. But I just love that. You're goddamn right, I do. So here come two words for you. Shut the fuck up.
And that's a great little scene, and that's just a great bit of writing and their delivery, and it's their chemistry, and that's a very good pick, Dingus. I wasn't being facetious.
There's a lot of good F words in Midnight Run, actually. Yeah. Does Freena threaten to stab someone in the neck with a fucking pencil?
Yeah.
Dingus, ask me what about what's his name? Let's do it. Come on. Let's do it. We can do it. Go. Ask me.
I don't think we can. What about what's his name?
What about him? I say, why don't you give him a call?
Why don't you give him a call?
What for?
Ask him about his house.
I want to call what's his name and ask him about his house.
Yeah.
All right, what's his number?
I don't know.
God, you're terrible at this. The line is, I don't know, I've never met him. Well, neither have I. What the fuck are you talking about? You're terrible at with mail and I, Dingus. You're horrible at it.
I don't own it. I can't get my hands on it.
Well, that would have been my number one pick, but since Dingus can't do the scene with me.
He got I don't know part. That's pretty good. But I think he wasn't acting there. He was actually saying.
Yeah, right. That was a very honest moment.
Absolutely right. I don't
know. My number one pick you guys haven't seen, so let me just throw out the line.
Ugh.
Effed his wife, effed his effing wife, you effing wife effer you, you effed his effing wife, you wife effing C.
Ugh, and I have to decode the whole clothes, Tom. I can't say anything. Certain vowels and consonants are offensive.
So you guys haven't seen this movie. It had a week-long run at the New Art here
it
recently.
It took the thief, the wife, and his lover.
It's been passed over by BAFTA, the British Film and Academy Awards, and Ray Winstone maintains it was because of the language. 44-inch Chest is a movie from the guys who wrote Sexy Beast, and it is, to me, I hope I'm not scooping anyone's pick here, but people traditionally think of David Mamet as someone who appreciates the poetry of profanity, and 44-inch Chest, the two guys who wrote that script, and the actors to whom they give this poetry do an amazing job with profanity. It is about five very English, very profane, coarse, amazing characters. It could be a stage play, but it's not. I mean, it's very cinematic. And just the continual use of the F word, and of course the C word, like nobody but the British can do it.
There's two different C words. That's why that one throws me even more.
Well, it's the super bad C word that when the English say it sounds super bad, but the way the British roll it off their tongue, it's just, it's something that only they can do. So 44
it has a different impact to them than it does to us, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. But 44-inch Chest is just an incredibly beautiful, and the movie, it's a brutal movie, but it is so oddly touching. It's a really warm movie in a strange way. But it's you can imagine Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast. It's that level of poetry spread amongst these five vividly realized characters. So my favorite use of the F word is 44-inch Chest, which is having very brief runs around the country and will hopefully be on DVD soon.
That's why you like Edge of Darkness, because you just Winstoned. That.
Well, that was part of my problem is Ray Winstone. Because you know the guys are obviously used to him from Sexy Beast. What they gave him to do in 44-inch Chest is just so spectacular compared to what he got to do in Edge of Darkness, which was so disappointing.
He was doing the Ben Kingsley Sexy Beast role.
Actually, not at all. Nope. Oh. Not at all. He was doing something. I mean, that's Ray Winstone is an amazing chameleon of an actor when you give stuff. And it's Ray Winstone like you haven't seen him before. Let me just tell you guys, the opening scene. You know what? No, I'm not even going to tell you. Screw you guys. You'll have to spit out. I know, that is. I'm not even going to tell you. So, all right. So there you go. That's my number one pick.
I'm shocked. I thought for sure we were going to get some in the loop kind of thing going on.
Oh, I saw that this week. That's so good.
That is also, yeah. Yeah.
Totally forgot to mention.
Capaldi in that. Oh, good point.
That's a great movie.
I'm still not changing my answer. That is a very good call.
Take Watchmen off.
All right. What's number one for you, Kelly? Your favorite use of the F word?
I will do a line from it, and you will pretend to know what I'm talking about.
What's that from?
Hey, asshole, how many times I got to tell you, get out from behind my bar. Put the drink down right now. Put the drink down right now. Fuck you. Fuck me. Fuck you.
What is some Goodfellas?
I'm on my fucking lunch break.
Oh, Office Space? Wait, hold on. Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
I'm not your fucking dada.
Blue Velvet.
Oh!
Yeah, I know Dingus has seen this, because he's mentioned it before on the podcast.
I don't think I know that.
Listen to. Why don't you go take a shower to a stripper? I'm a dancer, I sweat. Will you smell like a bum's nutsack? Fuck you.
I've never seen, if it's the one I'm thinking of, I've never seen it. With Showgirls? Is it Showgirl? No, I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about, Kelly. I don't know this.
Billy Bob Thornton?
One False Move?
Oh.
Oh, Bad Santa!
Yeah. The whole movie. Good Lord. Is one gigantic F word. I love that movie.
That's very good. Good.
I adore Bad Santa.
I do too. Yeah, I think we're all
classic film. I don't remember any of those lines though.
That's because you were trying not to hear them because you were with your parents or something.
Nice move, kind of deal. Yeah.
I'm always focused on the Frazzle stick car lines when I think of the word F. When I think of the F word in that movie. Frazzle stick. What the F is that?
The C is the F of this.
Nice.
Very confusing. So that's my number one, Bad Santa, the entire film.
Very good.
Unrated cut.
Very good. Dingus, nice. Are you doing the same trend for your number one? Is it just the entire film rather than one specific instance? Or what do you got for number one?
It's close, actually. This film has the best commentary on this word and the best use of this word, of this F word. And it has my single favorite line about the F word that doesn't use the F word. And it's one of my favorite films.
Shirley Valentine. And
Christmas. Oh, I.
What?
I think I know it and I didn't want to do Kelly Wand to you.
Did you say Christmas? Oh, I.
Nothing. Never mind. Go ahead.
All right. My single favorite line about the F word is this. I say it because it's descriptive.
Oh, so it's not Christmas Story?
It is not Christmas Story, no. although I had originally thought of that, and then a couple people ruined it, so I dropped it.
Right.
I mean, in the 3x3 thread. Which, by the way, good job starting that thread, Tom.
Oh, that's good. I don't know. Give me another line. That sounds familiar.
All right, then I'll do the exchange leading up to that.
Okay.
No, actually, I'll do a different line. A different line in this film is this. You never used to say the word fucking.
Oh, your Friends and Neighbors.
No.
Mm. Ah, rats. Oh, let's talk about that movie instead of whatever Dingus wants to talk about now.
I like that movie. Jason Patrick.
My number one film is directed by the same guy who directed Tom's number three film. And you got me nervous when you said his name at first, Tom.
Bubble? I'm just going to start rattling off Steven Soderbergh movies. It's got to be Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
It's Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And the use of the word and the act in this film is phenomenal. And this is another example, and one of the reasons why I just love that we do this 3x3 every week, because as happened with Goodfellas last week, I meant to just watch a scene of Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and I haven't seen it since I went to see it in a theater, and I just got... Somebody just gave me the DVD finally this year, and I just wanted to watch a couple scenes, and I just watched the whole film, and it's phenomenal. It's a phenomenal film, and you're just watching a guy start off and make one of the best films out there at the beginning of his career, and it's so exciting to watch with all of its sort of blemishes. It's brilliant. But how it deals with the F word is great, because the sister, Laura San Giacomo, is obviously she's very loose and she's having sex. This is not a reveal. This is not a spoiler. She's having sex with her sister's husband, Andy McDowell's husband, and she uses the F word. You can feel it in their relationship to sort of twist the knife with Andy McDowell, and it makes Andy McDowell uncomfortable. And she says, you know, if I decide to fuck his brains out, what business is it of yours? And they go back and forth about it. She says, well, why do you have to use that word? Why do you have to say that? Say what? You know what? And she says, I say it because it's descriptive. And then later on, you get, you never used to say the word fucking, which Andy McDowell says to her husband. And this is also, and I didn't realize this until I watched it again, this film is an excellent example of how voiceover can be used without being a narration. And you need to watch this film again. If you haven't seen it, you've got to watch it immediately. It's got this Altman way of overlapping scenes with dialogue, and it's done beautifully so that sometimes you think, who said that? And then it's clear who said it, but you were supposed to be confused by it. And how the F word is used by different characters, and at the end how Andie MacDowell tries to use it and totally fails, both as an actress and as a character, and how Steven Soderbergh uses her bad acting to his advantage is just freaking brilliant. And this is easily my favorite example of how the F word is used and commented on.
I like that movie, so I support you.
It might. That I'm glad to hear that you say that about Andie MacDowell as an actress. I saw her recently in this terrible horror film where she's a woman who thinks that Carrie Elwes is responsible for the murder of her husband, so she hires some thugs to exact revenge on him. And she's just awful in it, like, unwatchably awful. I mean, poor Carrie Elwes is bad enough. They're torturing him and whatnot. And then she comes in and she just, any hope the movie has to be anywhere near watchable or even maybe halfway thrilling or decent is just scuttled the moment she comes on screen and starts talking. So I'm fascinated to hear you say that about her in Sex, Lies, and Videotape. I love that and haven't seen it in a long time, so that's good to hear. Good.
I was so pleased to watch it again and be so excited about how good it is, because it has existed in my head as a movie I love for, I don't know, 20 years. I didn't look up the year. It strikes me as it's late 80s, maybe 89. But it has existed in my head as a movie I love. And to watch it again front to back, meaning to just watch a scene and to be that pleased with it. And she's not easy to watch, but it's perfect for this movie. And Peter Gallagher is great, and Laura San Giacomo is great, and James Spader is wonderful. It's beautifully made.
Good. All right. Very good, Dingus. I was surprised nobody picked like Glengarry Glen Ross.
That's a good one.
Damn.
Alec Baldwin's speech, F you, that's my name. There are certain actors too that are so good with that word. One of my favorite, I could listen to this guy just using the F word day in and day out. John Malkovich. Hearing that guy say F, boy, that's just great work. There's a moment at the beginning of Burn This. Good Lord. Or Burn After Reading. Shut up.
Burn
there's
This
a moment
After You Read This.
Where he's been called into the CIA office and there's all these other guys there. And they explain to him they're going to have to let him go because he has a drinking problem. And one of the agents says, you know, we have to let you go because you have a drinking problem. And John Malkovich says, F you, Peck, you're a Mormon. To you, everybody has a drinking problem. But just the way that John Malkovich can hit the right amount of just bite and nastiness when he says that word is just beautiful.
Well, that's Coen's too, so.
Yeah. They
know how to use every word well.
That's true. You're very careful with them. All right, who has next week's 3x3?
Who could it be?
I don't really like it. Can I have some time to think of a different one? Well, so here's what I was thinking of. How clumsy the scene was in Edge of Darkness with Luggage Lady in the car. And
wait a minute, you loved that movie.
But I was thinking of...
He loves ham.
It's like scenes with gas stations, where we talked before about how gas stations are part of the common experience. Everybody knows a gas station. So, and then we came up with some really cool scenes in gas stations. And there's something distinct about gas stations. They've got explosives underneath them. They could blow up. Yet everybody, you know, once a week you go to a gas station, you fill up your car. It's part of the shared experience. What I want from you guys are three scenes inside of cars. Three good car scenes. Because that's the thing. It's watching the Luggage Lady scene with Mel Gibson. I'm like, why are they in a car? And even with the way the shot was framed, I was like, you know what? As soon as she steps out, she's going to get hit by a car. I know movies. I know they're going to do that. And they did it. So that's why that was shot in a car, is because they wanted to do that cheap trick when she gets out. So what I want from you guys are three great uses of the fact that a scene is set in a car. And there's so many different ways you can go with this. Do what you will with it, but I just want to hear what that does.
Ben Affleck does the jump in Armageddon count as a car?
That's a space buggy.
Oh.
Thank you, James Cameron. You're so dangerously close to stealing one of my favorite 3x3s to come. I don't know. Tom.
You better hurry up.
Darn it.
Get off the pod, Dingus. You got to roll that out.
People site keep pitching kind of good ones, too. We can just steal the ones.
You know what I kept expecting to happen with cars in Edge of Darkness was I expected the senator to get in his car
and it blow up.
I just kept expecting the turn the key blow up.
Yes.
And it
yes.
never happened.
Exactly. Exactly. Because that's another one. Like, okay, I'm seeing how they're shooting, how they're framing this scene. I know what they're going to do. They're going to do it. And they didn't blow the car up, yeah. but I knew that one.
Oh, no, no. Well, it was the lawyer, the Mel Gibson.
Right. Yeah, no, I know exactly.
It's like, oh, you had some yep. spaghetti, and the lawyer gets in, and I thought, oh, this car's going to explode.
Right.
But
right.
No. So if Mel Stoddard had gotten run over like Luggage Girl and not poisoned, then would he have run over the senator?
You'd have to do some script dots.
Shot him?
Oh. I don't know. Yeah. Hmm. So there you go, gentlemen. I just need three scenes inside of cars. Trucks are okay. You know what I'm getting at. Just, you know, game it if you need to. But there's a lot you can play with. I'm curious to hear what you come up with.
Legion?
Do houses count?
that's an awesome question, Kelly. We'll check with
right,
the judge.
My list is done if it is. If they do.
Youth and Revolt.
Condos. Trailer.
What movie should we see? So, do we decide White Ribbon?
Yeah.
Yeah. Explain why, though.
So it's next week, terrible. Join us as we talk about When in Rome. Oh no! Join us as we talk about Frozen. Oh, ew, we don't want to do that. Join us when we talk about Dear John with Channing Tate. no, we don't want to do that one either. How about From Paris with Love with John Travolta's shaved head? And he's driving around shooting things in France. No, we don't want to do that. So rather than subject ourselves to any of those, it's been a long January, folks. We decided we're going to see something
good.
We presume is good. White Ribbon, All We Know, a foreign film by a fellow named Michael Haneke, who does amazing movies.
Aren't the podcasts better when we do crap, though?
Yeah, but you know what? That's sometimes
but we've suffered.
Exactly. We've suffered for our audience, and now it's our turn.
The listeners have had their shot at enjoying us.
Exactly. And we can also then, we can talk about other Michael Haneke movies. I mean, he's got a rich body of work, and yeah, we'll see where we go. So join us next week. I am Tom Chick. I have been here with Christian Martowski. Is that
it's
close?
Captain Christian Morowski.
And Kelly Wand. Kelly?
I hate Tom. Oh, it's radiation?